Hi, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 30th of May. 50 million people in this country suffer from seasonal allergies, and there are some who are saying that because we didn't have a good long freeze this past winter and we had warm temperatures returning early in the spring, it may mean that there is more pollen to go around, that this is a particularly difficult season for allergies. The most common allergens, pollen from trees, grass, and weeds, mold, animal dander, and dust. This hour of the program, we'll talk about whether or not there is a relationship between global warming and having a longer allergy season, and of course give you advice on what you can do about allergies. There are 50 million people who have allergies, so you may be one of them, and you may have some advice as well. Our guest this hour is Dr. Asriani Chu, who's an assistant professor of medicine, pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Chu deals with pediatric allergy and allergies of all ages, allergic diseases, asthma, immunology, immunotherapy, recurrent infections, and deficiencies, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Chu at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 227-2050. Hello, Dr. Chu? Whoops. Hello? We have a problem with the phone line, so we'll have to try Dr. Chu once again. Second hour of our program today, we're happy to have Michael Beschloss with us. His book is Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America from 1789 to 1989. He has been the author of a number of books on American presidents and is the presidential historian for NBC News, as well as a contributor to PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He writes about the times in history when presidents, you know, it's Washington and Adams and Truman, Kennedy, Reagan, Teddy Roosevelt, and others had to make unpopular decisions, but they were incredibly important for the future of the country. So he will be with us, hour number two of our show, to talk about presidential courage. You may want to add other acts of courage that you think presidents have displayed, or take issue with them, or ask questions. I mean, some of these are not very well-known moments in history, so we're going to learn a few things, hour number two. And I believe we have our guest with us now. Dr. Chu?
Yes, I'm there. Sorry about that.
That's all right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, sure.
So there's been some question, and I understand there aren't a lot of statistics kept on this, but do you think that there is any kind of relationship between global warming and a longer allergy season, thus more sufferers?
I know that that is a question that comes up actually very recently, more often. And you're exactly right. There probably isn't long-term data. But if you look at the fact that many of the seasonal pollens do need, obviously, you know, warm environments, sun, those kind of things that would nurture and develop those pollen seasons, it probably is not unrealistic to think that that does contribute to the longer pollen seasons.
Mm-hmm. When do people get allergies? Are they with you when they're born, a susceptibility to them?
That's a great question. There's very interesting data to suggest that it's both genetic, meaning a familial predisposition, a family history of any kind of allergic disease is going to make the individual more likely to have allergies. And then, of course, you need that kind of environmental exposure. So the two of them together, genetics and environment, really contribute to the development of allergies.
Mm-hmm. And can you outgrow them?
That's also a very good question. We know that probably if you look at the prevalence of allergic disease, younger children can develop it. Then for some reason there may be something about puberty and hormonal changes. It may become more quiescent. And then it can actually come back kind of in their adult years. So there are some people that will, quote unquote, outgrow it or become more tolerant. And then there are others that continues throughout their life.
Mm-hmm. And the most common, is there one that's most common? Is it mold? Is it grass? What
you know,
is it?
It's a great question because I wouldn't necessarily say that there's something as an allergic trigger that's most common. Now, it depends on the area. And, of course, here in the Midwest, we are pretty good for ragweed season, which is in the fall. So you have a lot of people who kind of suffer through the fall ragweed allergies. But, you know, a lot of the patients that come through our clinic, really, it runs the gamut from the seasonal pollens of trees, which we're kind of at the end at. We're going to start with grass season coming up soon, all the way through the ragweed pollen. And then scattered throughout are going to be your mold allergic patients, and then some of the more indoor things like the dust mite or animal dander.
Mm-hmm. And do we know when we get this? It's sort of a fine line, isn't it? Or you don't exactly know unless you're keen on allergies,
sure.
And you know they exist. Is it, you don't know if you have a cold, kind of a minor cold or
yeah.
bronchitis, or if you're allergic, or what the heck's going
yeah,
on?
Yeah, that's a great question, too, because I think what's helpful about allergies is if there is a pattern that's been set, then, you know, maybe at the beginning, you're right. You think it is kind of that every time the season changes, I get a typical virus and a cold, and it goes away. But if you notice, you know, year after year, that particular time of year seems to be more problematic for you. Or, thankfully, you know, yeah, it might have seemed like a cold, but, boy, it's lingering longer than a cold mm-hmm. should be, which typically a virus is maybe 7 to 10 days in duration. Sometimes you get some discolored drainage with it, too. But this is kind of clear, watery drainage. You add a little bit of itchy eyes on top of that or itchy throat. Those things can help you kind of pinpoint that this may, in fact, be more allergic than something like an infectious cause.
Mm-hmm. And how do you determine? It seems to me as though we should have a better system for this now, but I know a lot of people go and have those skin tests
sure.
where you get pricked to find out what you are allergic to.
Exactly.
Number one, is that how you determine whether or not you're allergic to something? And number two, why doesn't that advance so you don't have to have your skin pricked with all these needles?
That's a great question. But actually, there is some advance. I'll probably address that in a little bit. But, you know, what I end up telling patients or families, and you can imagine as an allergist, we get sidelined a lot. So it's
oh, I'm sure you do. Right.
Especially in this area. But, you know, if, again, the person kind of seasonally can say, boy, I know come middle of August, all the way through the first frost, I have these typical, quote, allergy symptoms. You know, they take maybe an over-the-counter antihistamine and they're fine. They really probably don't have to come and see an allergy specialist because they, you know, are able to look at the pollen counts and realize that it's ragweed, for example. I think the more difficult one is if someone has kind of, they feel chronically congested, either pretty much all year or definitely all year round,
mm-hmm.
then you what would be important to determine is if you can identify, is it multiple seasons that they're allergic to, or really is it something indoor that's year-round? And that's, I think, where the benefit of doing allergy testing really comes in, because many of these things, once you find out what you're allergic to, you can actually try to do some environmental controls. And maybe I can kind of clarify, too.
Sure.
I wouldn't say that the skin testing determines, or any allergy testing, determines what you're allergic to. We really use it as a confirmatory test, so it confirms what you're allergic to so you can identify it instead of just presuming, oh, it's probably this. So it kind of helps to just confirm things for you. The type of testing that we have now, and you're exactly right, I was kind of kidding around with a patient yesterday who had testing when he was a young child, so, you know, he was kind of a little leery. We don't use, like, they used to use lancets and literally scratch the skin. They're more little prick tests
right.
that are, I guess, a little more humane and very well tolerated, even in young children,
mm-hmm.
To tell you the truth, and are very safe as well.
Mm-hmm. So if you have allergies all year round, you're most likely allergic to something in the house, be it dust or your cat or your dog?
Yes, or molds, because there are some outdoor molds and there are some indoor molds, too. And then, of course, with some of the things that we bring indoors, sometimes that helps to contribute to the mold as well.
Mm-hmm. What's the relationship, Dr. Chu, between allergies and asthma?
There is a high tendency for patients that have allergic nasal symptoms, or what we term allergic rhinitis. Other people would know it as hay fever and asthma. I think the studies actually quote somewhere between 2/3 of patients that have asthma will have allergic rhinitis. Probably not so high that patients that have allergic rhinitis have asthma. There's kind of a little discrepancy between the two diseases. And patients that have the upper respiratory or allergic rhinitis disease can develop into the lower respiratory asthma disease, too.
Mm-hmm. And what about the state of medications for all of this now? Do you need to suffer if you've got a grass allergy now or a mold allergy? Can you relieve this head congestion, the sneezing, et cetera, or not completely yet?
Oh, I think that the medications have really made a headway into how we can treat allergic rhinitis. You know, back in the older days when maybe there was only one or two different antihistamines and they just knocked you out or sedated you,
yeah.
is really no longer the case. There are good antihistamines that are non-sedating and actually easy to take, like let's say once a day, maybe twice a day if you needed to. So that's also easier on the frequency of having to take it. But in addition to those, what's really made a difference is there now are nasal cortisone sprays that are anti-inflammatory. So in fact, what they're trying to do is take care of the inflammation in your nose, all those allergy cells that are recruited to your nasal passages, which release all those histamine and chemicals and mediators, so that you're kind of getting at the root of the problem, so you may not even need to take oral antihistamine. So the nasal sprays have really made a big difference in regards to our treatment plan offers.
And can you take those over a long period of time, or do they lose their effectiveness?
You can take them for a long period of time. The nasal cortisone sprays that are by prescription at this point are completely different from the topical nasal decongestants, where I know a lot of people appropriately are concerned with quote-unquote getting addicted. And what they mean to those addiction of the nasal decongestants is they work in a different mechanism, so that if you keep using those nasal decongestants, and their mechanism is to shrink up the blood flow, so then, you know, you can breathe again, kind of like some of the commercials show you. If you stop using it, in fact, those blood vessels balloon out, and you actually feel worse. Mm. So that's why you have to keep using it, which is obviously can become a medical condition in and of itself.
Right.
And that's different from the nasal cortisone sprays. They're very safe. I mean, some people get kind of a local irritation, little bloody nose, and usually if we review the correct technique and how to spray them kind of to the side of the nose or laterally, that can also, that usually does help to relieve the irritation.
Mm-hmm. And what about those shots? Are those effective?
Allergy injections are remarkably effective, and they're also very safe. I mean, they've been given for literally for decades, and you know, a lot of studies have shown that. And what they're trying to do is change the what we call kind of the allergic response to a more protective response, literally like a regular vaccine, like a tetanus booster, one of those where you're trying to build up a blocking antibody so that you can, you know, again, really tolerate what you were previously allergic to. We know that they're very effective, but unfortunately, one of the things that kind of prohibit most people is we're such a busy society that it's hard to actually kind of make that time commitment of coming in on a weekly basis as you build up the dose, and then ultimately to a once-a-month maintenance, which once you get there, then it's okay. But it's kind of that build-up phase I think most people have difficulty getting at. But it's really been shown to be very effective as well.
And do you see any advancement in that technology in the future, Dr. Chu, so you could take a shot maybe, you know, once every 6 months?
Yeah, there are a lot of areas of research going on, not necessarily in just the idea of an injection, but what are we actually giving in that injection? Right now, we're giving the proteins in kind of greater concentrations of what the person's allergic to. So let's say ragweed protein or, you know, cat dander protein. They're actually looking into, with research, you know, making it the more allergenic part of the protein, yet not having it with the potential of having an allergic reaction. So they're trying to make it, I guess in a sense, really directed to that part of the protein that the person may be allergic to. They're also doing studies, looking at different therapies, not just injection, but something called sublingual or under-the-tongue immunotherapy. Unfortunately, here in the United States right now, it hasn't been as effective because they probably haven't done as high dose as they are doing in Europe, so the studies are still going on, and the type of sublingual immunotherapy that's offered currently in the United States is probably not at the level that you know, they're really looking at with the controlled trials and things like that, so there's still some research that needs to be done.
We're going to go to phone calls because there are millions of us who suffer from allergies, I would imagine. Our phone lines will get quite busy. Our guest this hour is Dr. Aswiani Chu, and Dr. Chu is at the Medical College of Wisconsin, Assistant Professor of Medicine, Pediatrics. She deals with allergic diseases, asthma, immunology, immunotherapy, and we're welcoming phone calls. I know that many of you have tried all kinds of different things. We'll answer your questions about how to determine what allergies might be, whether or not they are allergies or there's something else. I think it's very difficult to come up with definitive answers sometimes in all of this because there are other possibilities of what you could have. 800-486-8655 is the number. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050. 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Allergies this hour of the program. Dr. Asriani Chu is our guest, and we start our phone calls with Adrian from Milwaukee. Hi, Adrian.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good, good. Doctor, I cured my allergies. I will say cured simply because most of them are gone.
Good.
I had horrible allergies from the time I was five, and my family put me on an antihistamine, and by the time I hit my 40s, it was the antihistamines were killing my liver.
Okay. Mm.
So I had to do something else,
sure.
And I discovered something called grapeseed extract,
okay.
Which is one of the highest antioxidants known to man.
Okay.
I did something called saturation the first week, which means you take a little bit more than you need. And then I went to one 50-milligram pill, which I've been on for years.
Okay.
It took, as with anything natural, it takes a little while. So it took 6 months before I saw any results.
Mm-hmm.
And within a year, I was fine. And you're talking to a person who would sneeze from the time I got up in the morning until about 11 o'clock.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I had horrible. I had the most adorable little Japanese allergist didn't speak very good
sure.
English, who did a scratch test
uh-huh.
on me and said, you know, if it was up to me, I would put you in a room and pump in oxygen.
Oh,
wow.
No.
That's how bad I was.
Okay.
All right. What do you know about this grapeseed extract, Dr. Chu?
I don't know much. In fact, I was kind of trying to see if I could look it up now. I know one of the things about our traditional medical training, if I could say that, is we really don't do a lot of looking into the alternative therapies. And I know the medical schools nowadays are trying to offer courses in that so that we could supplement our training. The hard part is that many times the herbal supplements and things, and you're right, I mean, it's obviously an antioxidant, it's helpful. The prescription antihistamines were obviously giving you some side effects and adverse effects with your liver, you mentioned. So you had some limitations because of the side effects from the medications. The hard part is, and I'm so thankful that it worked for you, that at this point I don't think there are any clinical trials. And, you know, in medicine, a lot of times we want to obviously ensure the safety, the efficacy mm-hmm. of the medications or the treatment before really saying that it's good for everyone. So, again, I'm very glad that you did so well, especially for how miserable you were. But, again, it's hard to say, you know, if grapeseed extract would be something that would be helpful for everyone until we saw some kind of study to really document that.
Yeah. Well, what about studies of some of the alternative medicines?
Yeah.
As you know, people are going to those, acupuncture
oh, sure.
And all kinds of different alternative medicines. Will there be studies?
There have been some studies. Now, you can imagine some of them are limited because it depends on the type of treatment that are being offered as well as specifically what kind of condition. I know, for example, there was a chiropractic study sponsored actually by, I believe, the Canadian Institute of Chiropractors. It was actually published in the New England Journal a few years ago, specifically looking if chiropractic manipulation would help asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't. Mm. It was able to be shown, of course, as you can imagine, to be very beneficial for back disease and musculoskeletal things. But for asthma in particular, it did not help. There have also been some studies, again, limited perhaps in number, looking at exactly like you mentioned, acupuncture. There have been other kind of herbal remedies. I think there's some with I want to say rose water teas, and then there's some other Chinese herbal supplements. And again, if you look at what it's actually offering compared to placebo or the sugar pill, it really didn't make much difference mm-hmm. in those control trials, if
mm-hmm.
I can call them that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Adrian, for your call. We go to Pat next from Brantwood. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Hi.
I was really glad to hear that your guest talked about the drop. Because I have been using them, and my sister has for the last 10 years. We've been going to the La Crosse Allergy Clinic, and that they only use the drops there.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to stress that they have made a difference. I had some food allergies when I started, which are gone now. And I did take the drops, or I did take the shots originally when I was in my 20s, and
sure.
I'm almost 70 now. And they helped me for about 20 years. And then when I took the second series of drugs, then it didn't help me at all. And that's why I went to the allergy clinic. in La Crosse. Mm-hmm. And it just, to me, it seems that we've had so much trouble getting insurance and stuff and to pay for them, and it seems as though the conventional medicine, the allergist, and the insurance are kind of combined against the drops, because, first of all, it's a lot cheaper because you don't only have to visit your doctor one or two times a year. And then you take the drops and you use them at home, and you don't have to be running for a shot every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I wish that more people knew about it, because it's really helpful, and I wish the conventional allergists would allow more testing and to actually look at that, because it's been used in Europe for about 20 years.
It has been, and not to interrupt you, and you're exactly right. I think what needs to be done is, if you look at how much of the concentration of the protein you get in Europe, though, it is much higher than the concentration that we're giving here in the United States.
Hmm.
Again, as with the other caller, I'm very glad that it's been shown to be helpful for you. And that is exact. I mean, most patients will come in here, if you have to give them the option of an injection, needles, nobody likes needles compared to something like a drop. So I hope you don't get the sense that we're, you know, trying to put roadblocks up for this kind of therapy, because, again, research is going on. But the problem is, when you look at the lower concentration of the sublingual immunotherapy, it really hasn't been shown to be helpful. You have to get to the levels that they do in Europe, and you exactly hit it on the head, just like with the herbal supplements. That stuff is expensive on your own, because usually insurance doesn't cover it, so we kind of have to relook at the whole thing. And once the data and the research is out there to show that it's helpful, I can guarantee you it's going to skyrocket, because, as you mentioned, more people would rather do that kind of a treatment than something like an injection.
Mm-hmm. Well, why are they doing higher levels in Europe and not here?
Well, because, to tell you the truth, the sublingual immunotherapy that was done here or is being done here, unless it's in this research trials right now, looking at sublingual, has unfortunately been on the lower end. And part of it is, if you can imagine, if you're doing something under the tongue, you're going to be swallowing it and it gets digested. So you have to get to certain levels. Now, why those levels weren't higher here, I really can't say, because I wasn't really involved with that. But that's why in Europe, they know that you need to go to those higher concentrations, because, you know, the enzymes in our own GI tract are going to break down those proteins. So essentially, if it's too low of a concentration, again, it's back to the issue of, are you really getting any efficacy or effective relief from it, or is it essentially something like placebo?
Right. Thanks so much for your call. We have a couple lines open. They rapidly were filled, and if you want to join us, we have lines open at 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. We have an email question, and let me give this to you. My allergies seem so variable. This is James from Madison. I don't have any idea what the cause is. The worst system is pressure in my head that makes me feel really spacey, especially in the evening. Had it checked out once as a kid, and I believe it was caused by fluid buildup in the eustachian tubes in the ear. Could you comment or offer any advice?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. The typical allergy symptoms are going to be more the runny, the itchy, the sneezy, but you can definitely get congestion, or what I would be like subjective swelling, or just a sensation of fullness. And what we talk about kind of along the lines of why we talked about the nasal cortisone sprays, if all that pressure buildup is really related to swelling or inflammation, let's say in your nasal passages or in your sinuses,
mm-hmm.
And that can happen with a cold or a virus or an infection, but definitely if it's allergic in nature and it happens all the time, you can have that sensation of just feeling so congested, really kind of out of it. You're not getting good night's rest. All those kind of things contribute. So that perhaps for James, if he gets an updated allergy evaluation, to just say, hey, maybe if this is happening in the evening, is there something either in the workplace or any hobbies that he might be exposing himself to something, especially if it's not just during, you know, seasonal allergy seasons or times of the year. And it can help, because then, you know, whether or not he could benefit from those nasal cortisone sprays, or perhaps even an antihistamine, maybe with a little bit of a decongestant, if he doesn't have any other medical conditions, that might be helpful as well. Because as we mentioned to our patients, if the nose and the sinuses and the ear canals are all linked, as they are, mm-hmm. you know, really it can give you that sensation of ear fullness and
right.
all those things. So I think it would be very helpful for him to get that further evaluated.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, James, for your email. We go to Craig from Park Falls. Hi, Craig.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. I've got a question about allergies to antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
Both my sons, when they were really young, had a lot of ear infections,
okay.
and then they were given by their pediatrician, penicillin or something like that, and they both had some reactions to penicillin, and I'm a typical dad. I don't remember all the names of all these penicillins
sure.
or whatnot, but, you know, they didn't have a violent reaction or anything like that, but now they're 13 and 17 years old, and my concern is I wonder if they ever outgrow a allergy to any sort of medication like that, antibiotics. And I guess what I'm really concerned about is that they had to go to some other classifications of antibiotics, and, you know, it eliminated several varieties. And you hear about all these people that develop resistance to allergies, and I'm just wondering if there's any way to confirm whether my kids are still allergic to it without, you know, jeopardizing. Mm-hmm. And if every time I brought it up to a doctor, they say, well, okay, we'll just give you the what we know does work.
Sure. No, let me just say
that I almost died from a penicillin reaction Ooh. When I was very young, and I have never taken it
sure.
since.
Right.
And it's been, and, you know, I just take something else, and
right.
I'm not young anymore, so I think you just stay away from it, can't you, Dr. Chu?
You're exactly right, but I think the caller has brought up a very good point, because it can get, in a sense, confusing, or, boy, is this something that's lifelong? I think in your case, Kathleen, because you had a very severe reaction, you are doing exactly the right thing. You know, there's enough alternatives and options that are out there that will still be able to treat, let's say, the bacterial
mm-hmm.
infection that you have. For your children, for example, I think that the important part is, if there are alternatives to use, and there still are, and in fact, as they're now in their teenage years, 13 and 17, I think you mentioned,
mm-hmm.
There are even more options available compared to when they were younger, because there are some antibiotic choices that you want to be careful about in the younger children. And so the thought is still that, depending on the reaction that they had, you mentioned mild, but depending on the reaction, if there are alternatives, it is probably better to still use them. Now, that's not to say that down the line, if, for example, excuse me, you know, there was a particular bacteria that they had an infection to, and you know, absolutely needed a penicillin type of antibiotic, at some point doing some kind of testing would be helpful, and or possibly what's called a desensitization procedure, where you give the medication kind of in these increasing doses to a dose that they tolerate, for example. But those have obviously some risks involved with it, so we don't just lightly go into some kind of procedure like that. Why don't I say go do skin testing right now? Part of the hard part is our skin testing for drugs are fairly limited.
Mm.
As you can imagine, the body breaks down that antibiotic or any medication into a metabolite or a broken down product. And then it's that broken down metabolite that then gets kind of like a protein from our cells. And it's that complex that then can cause the allergic reaction. It's very rare, if not at all, that the whole compound would cause a problem for you. And the thing is, the only testing for, or the only drugs that we can test for these little metabolites is penicillin. So you'd probably say, oh, that would be good for my boys. But due to some manufacturing difficulties, the type of metabolites we have are limited. So in other words, if the allergist that, let's say, your doctor sent your sons to, was able to do the skin testing and it was positive, then good. It would kind of just confirm what they've been doing all along. If it's negative, and again, mm-hmm. depending on the reaction your kids had, it wouldn't give us that much peace of mind or reassurance to say, oh, go ahead and take it, because of the limitations of the testing. So
I guess I'm more comforted to hear that there's a lot more varieties out
yes,
there.
Yes.
And because, you know, I was sort of feeling a little bit trapped.
Sure.
With, you know, at that time, my kids were, like, getting more and more infections
mm-hmm.
for a while, and they grew out of all
sure.
that. But I thought, geez, they're also developing resistance towards
right.
what
right.
they can take.
Right. Mm-hmm. And bringing up the resistance again, not to interrupt, that's a great question. I think that's kind of where I can mention at this point as well that that's why it's so important for both patients, families, and even the physicians or clinicians that provide care for them to really make sure that these are truly bacterial infections. As we talked about earlier in the show, a virus can last 7 to 10 days, sometimes even 2 weeks. So oftentimes you'll hear the physician saying, well, we got to wait. Well, it's not because we don't want to give you something to put you out of the suffering or the misery, but more because we want to make sure that it is a bacterial infection and not a virus that will go away on its own. And so that's what's important, because where resistance to antibiotics comes in is if the person is inappropriately giving an antibiotic, so it wasn't even bacterial to begin with, that can cause or breed resistance. Another is, unfortunately, we still hear it all the time, someone got a course of antibiotics, took the antibiotics, started feeling better, stopped the antibiotics,
yeah.
and then maybe months later they kind of said, oh, yeah, I still have some of those antibiotic pills still left, took it for something else. That kind of pattern is more likely to cause resistance to antibiotics than, for example, if your kids were appropriately, you know, weighted to make sure it was bacterial and put on a different antibiotic than
the
penicillin.
Yeah. Thanks, Craig, very much for your call.
Thank you.
Are we noticing, I'm sure there must be records kept when it comes to this, are we noticing more people with allergies now, Dr. Chu?
We are. And that's a great question, too, because at one point we're all like, well, we're just presuming, but is the data actually there? There was a recently published database through the NIH. I think it's the National Health something or other database, and you can see that there is an increasing prevalence in allergic disease. Now, that lumps all allergic disease, so we can't really just say, oh, it's only allergic rhinitis or it's only asthma, but kind of lumps all of that together to say there is a prevalence in food allergies and things like that.
And the reason for that would be?
You know, again, it's probably that combination of genetic and environmental. I know one of the other hypotheses that are being thrown out there, you've probably heard about it, is something called the hygiene hypothesis, whether now that we've become a more, quote, sterile or clean environment, we're no longer living with rural animals like we did before, that might contribute. And the reason that might contribute is the living in kind of the farm or rural areas where you have, it sounds kind of gross, but, you know, the droppings and the manure and some of these other things which grow what are called endotoxins, because then our body has to kind of fight off some of those things, there's a less of a tendency to develop the allergic process.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, since we're kind of quote-unquote clean and our body's not really fighting those things anymore, the thought is then it starts getting kind of surveys other systems, which include ourselves, and then we become hypersensitive to things in the environment.
Oh, interesting. So when you look at animal allergies, mm-hmm. Would it hold that you would be less likely to be allergic to a cat or a dog if you grew up with one? If you were, you know, you were born, you had a dog in the house.
Yeah, and that's an excellent question as well. The controversy, however, is in the studies that have been done, the timing of the cat or dog is very, very important. So in other words, you're right, if the, let's say the mom and dad or the couple had a pet beforehand, baby was born, so baby kind of grew up with it, they have shown that it's not as likely potentially to develop allergies, and I'll come back to that in a second. However, if let's say the child is 2 years of age and then they get a pet cat or dog, you know, they still can have that potential for developing the allergies. Another thing that I've actually seen many times is, and they, when they come to clinic, you know, they grew up with that cat or dog. They went away for school or for whatever reason, come back home, and boy, their allergies start acting up because they hadn't, again, been exposed, whether it be low dose or whatever, to those animals.
Hmm.
And then back to the study, you know, it's certainly something where we don't prescribe having a pet or whatever before the child is born, because, again, that was one study that mentioned it, and I know that there's a number of studies that are now looking into really, was that just a one-time study mm-hmm. that showed that, or, you know, is this something that is going to be borne out?
Susan from Greendale. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. I have a question regarding diet and exercise for managing asthma, and more specifically, I was interested in your take on underlying food allergies that contribute to asthma and foods that may aggravate inflammation and other foods that may help to reduce inflammation. And my understanding is that sometimes the increase in foods in our society's diet has contributed to the increase in allergies overall.
Okay.
I was wondering if you can comment on that, please.
Wow, those are really good things to bring up, too. I'll see if I can try to break. You mentioned something about, are there certain foods that are more anti-inflammatory that can help, I think is kind of what you
mm-hmm.
mentioned. Good question. Other than perhaps the ones that we know may have some antioxidant properties, those kind of things, I don't think there's a lot of literature or research that's been up to really say you need to eat such and such a product in order to cause some anti-inflammatory effects. I think I still believe in the golden rule or moderation in all things would be very beneficial because, again, I don't think there's a lot of information out there. Now, that's not to say as with, cardiovascular disease or cancer, I mean, a good mix of fruits and vegetables and those kind of things would be very, very helpful, but I don't think that there's any specific food group that we can say, whoa, will be very helpful for someone that has asthma, allergic disease. Now, back to, I think part of your question, too, was kind of, are there associations with food allergies and asthma? I think you had, did I understand that correctly? We know that it's very interesting. As a child, or in children, I should say, it's not uncommon for foods to contribute to maybe their asthma. So in other words, if they have, and I'll use one that's a fairly common one, fish allergy, even if someone is cooking fish, let's say, in the room, sometimes the proteins, the fumes, can actually contribute to their asthma exacerbation, and they start wheezing and having a more systemic reaction. For some reason, it happens to be that it's the younger population or the children that foods can contribute to their asthma being that much out of control. As I think the GI tract matures, it's not as common for adults, for example, to really say that a particular food only caused their asthma to get out of control. Usually, if an adult's going to have a food allergy, unfortunately, it's kind of the whole, systemic reaction from whether it be hives and swelling to the full-blown effect to shellfish or peanuts or tree nuts or one of those. Very uncommon for it just to contribute to only asthma. But again, we have to be, of course, careful if someone thinks that they're allergic to a food, identify it so that they can, make sure to avoid it as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Susan, for the call. More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Our guest this hour, as we talk about allergies, conversation prompted by some reports, and I guess they're anecdotal, that this is a very difficult allergy season for many people, and perhaps because the weather's been warmer and we haven't had as long a freeze, spring has come a little bit earlier, that more people are suffering. So we're trying to alleviate what suffering you have and determine the causes of allergies, how many allergies there are, how they are treated, the relationship between allergies and asthma, all of that with Dr. Asriani Chu, who is Assistant Professor of Medicine Pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and her patient care emphases are allergic diseases, asthma, immunology, immunotherapy, recurrent infections, and primary immunodeficiencies. 800-486-8655. Couple lines are open. In Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our show this Wednesday, we'll be speaking with Michael Beschloss. His latest book, Presidential Courage, Brave Leaders and How They Changed America, 1789 to 1989. He talks about George Washington, John Adams, Andrew Jackson, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, and Ronald Reagan. So that's coming up. Back to phone calls now for Dr. Chu. Judy is our next caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Judy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am curious about something. I moved to Milwaukee in 1994 from New York City, come from a very allergic family, and I expected every spring in New York that I'd be a bit uncomfortable for about a week, and allergy tests confirmed that I was allergic to certain pollens in the spring. But it wasn't particularly dramatic living in New York. When I got here, I thought I was awful. and I didn't even know if I'd be able to continue to live in Milwaukee. Mm. And I read a book called Natural Healing by Dr. Andrew Weil, and he said to take something called quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N, for 6 weeks before the allergy season, that it would do something with histamines, and the allergy has been gone ever since. I've been taking it. I started 6 weeks before the allergy season, and if you're telling me this is a bad allergy season, this is the first I've known of it.
Hmm.
And I wonder, what is that and why does it work? I think it's an aspect of vitamin C, but I'm just not sure.
And yet we probably don't have tests on it again, right, Dr.
Exactly.
Chu?
Exactly, and I think you're right. I'm looking, it does have some antioxidant activity. It is kind of in the vitamin C maybe category, and that may be why it's helpful for you, but you're exactly right. There haven't been studies to really document. I'm just very glad that you're improved. And I think it goes to show that people, whether they're coming from different parts of the United States where there's different pollens that are involved, you know, whether it's from the East Coast coming to the Midwest, or we have a number of people coming from the West Coast coming here to Milwaukee, for example, at the medical school. We have a lot of students from the West Coast. They tend to be kind of the other way around. They do okay the first couple of years they're in school, and then they come and see us because they've now had those two seasons to see the ragweed or our particular tree pollens, for example. And then they become miserable by about their second or third year here. You know, and then there's other things that are more the dust, mite, and molds, which tend to be, they kind of cross all the areas in the United States and maybe even in Europe and other countries, so that it really doesn't matter what part of the country you're in. So, but you're right, with this quercetin, I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right, it may be that there are some antioxidant effects that have been helpful as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I'm glad it worked for you.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
I'm never going to know. It's just
right.
One of those miracles. Because I had, of course, over the years, I tried vitamin C and other things, and none of them worked.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this was the only thing that ever did, and that's what was so fluky about it.
The other thing is, though, it may have been kind of your own natural, that's how your body or your system was, as I mentioned before, kind of when you're younger, maybe there's that tendency for allergic disease. Something happens kind of around puberty or our teen years, and we get better, and then symptoms kind of recur or don't recur. So, again, you may be one of those patients with that kind of a natural history as well.
Thanks so much, Judy, for your call. We go next to Larry from Cottage Grove. Hi, Larry.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Dr. Chu.
Good morning.
You really hit a nerve with me when you brought up this subject. I'm 62 now, but in fourth grade I got this chronic rhinitis and took shots for many, many years. I can remember the large lumps I used to get on my arms and the pain from the shots. And really treated the symptoms, didn't get a lot better, but had some symptomatic relief through drugs and things. And then I tried the drops, and the drops helped quite a bit.
Okay.
But indirectly, what really, all my allergies and problems disappeared at 40, and I believe it was due to something I did indirectly, and that was my vision was really bad, and I was having all kinds of trouble. I'd also worn glasses from fourth grade to 40, but I got into vision training, and I was able to read a number of books by an ophthalmologist, Dr. Bates, and in several other books, and lo and behold, I was able to relax myself into better eyesight. They use relaxation techniques, mental narcotics, they call them. And the side effect of that, all of a sudden, when my vision improved, was that my allergies disappeared. And I never had a problem again. I rarely have ever hit a cold. And I can't tell you the number of antibiotics I went through and the over-the-counter allergy things, and I really suffered, so I have a lot of empathy for people that suffer for allergies. I couldn't be around dogs or pets, and now we're on our second Cocker Spaniel. Maggie May is our second one. We had one 15 years, but I couldn't even get near a pet. But the whole theory behind this is that when you have normal circulation, the nerves and muscles function normally. And they believe a lot of it was due to the mind-body connection. And I firmly believe in that. And I just had to make a comment on that. Mm-hmm. But having suffered so much with chronic rhinitis and then having it disappear, I almost forget I even had it. So
yeah.
Just had to make a comment.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks for the call. Well, and the relaxation techniques are recommended for asthmatic patients at times, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of the times, and not that we're ever saying that it's in their head or anything, but if there's a stressful situation and stress can contribute or be a trigger to that person's asthma, trying to relax would certainly be helpful. And again, with someone, I guess my kind of philosophy or background is, you know, since everything in moderation is very good, mm-hmm. something like relaxation, I mean, I'm all for it as long as it's not allowing the person to rely only on that and not on medications that may have been prescribed. But I'm glad for that gentleman that's great that he was so miserable before and then now has been able to really even benefit from having pets and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Larry, so much for the call. Jean is next Jeannie. Hi, Jeannie.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Our son had asthma like in the junior high years, and we eliminated all of the allergens in the house and took some things out of the school and used air filters and got it totally under control to the point that he took no medications and had no symptoms for years. And suddenly he lost 80 pounds on Jenny Craig over about 5 months, and it's come back with a vengeance, and now we can't seem to get rid of it. Do you have any experience or any thoughts on why you think a rapid weight loss would cause?
How old is he?
19. Well, he was 18 when he lost the weight.
Mm-hmm.
And how much weight did he lose?
About 80 pounds in 5 months.
Wow.
Wow, that is pretty. And if you don't mind me asking, was it something that, I mean, was he overweight and this was something that he needed to do?
Oh, yes, he was. He went to Jenny Craig and it was totally working with their foods.
That is very interesting. The reason why I say that is, you may be aware that there's been an increase in obesity, especially childhood obesity. There's been an increase in asthma. So there's a lot of research actually going on is what came first, what's the cause and relationship. And many of the patients, their young children that we have that are overweight or qualify as obese, we really kind of counsel and work with them to try to lose weight so that can also help their asthma because then they can exercise more and
mm-hmm.
be more active.
Mm-hmm.
So I've not heard of the situation with your son where, losing the weight caused or contributed to the asthma to flare up again, unless, and again, I don't know, do you feel like because he's lost the weight, he's now become more active, and then because he's more active, then that's why he's noticing more of the asthma symptoms? Could that be contributing?
No, it's exactly the opposite. His asthma keeps him from being active.
Oh.
When he was a kid, he was in football and all kinds of things, and with his asthma, now it seems much worse.
Wow. Okay.
I'm concerned that I think there's a lot of wheat in most of their products, and perhaps he didn't eat as many vegetables outside of the product because he was so focused on losing, and we're trying to reverse that. But I don't seem to be making any ground even trying to take the wheat out of his diet.
I guess in that situation, too, especially because I bet he's probably likes the way that he looks and feels better with some of the weight loss, what might help is, at least from the standpoint of ruling out, is it a food allergy? Maybe seeing an allergist and getting an allergy test to wheat at least might give you some peace of mind to say, oh, no, it wasn't that he's exposing himself to all this wheat. Or, yes, it confirms how I feel as a mom that I'm kind of concerned about this and that maybe he should avoid some of those foods.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's time to go to a doctor on this. Yeah. Good luck, Jeannie. Thanks so much for your call. We go to Jim next. Hi, Jim.
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, doctor.
Hi.
I wanted to share with you an experience I had with my son. He's had actually asthma and allergies, and we would work through several things, but mainly the allergies were his biggest problem in the springtime. And the antihistamines that you had talked about earlier, like we used to take the grape syrup, Zyrtec, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, Zyrtec.
Uh-huh. And he'd get drowsy or tired with that. And he just didn't seem to be as awake in school. And we finally found, we used some of the over-the-counter antihistamines too and found some relief. But our doctor, pediatrician, actually prescribed this medicine called Singulair. And it seemed to not cause him to be as sleepy.
Sure.
And he seemed to have pretty good toleration to it, and it seemed to work pretty well for him. Is it an antihistamine?
Great.
Or how does it work?
Yeah, let me answer that. That's good, and thank you for bringing that up, because I know earlier we had talked about anti-inflammatory medications, but talked about more of the nasal cortisone sprays. Singulair, or the generic name, is Montelukast.
is also an anti-inflammatory medication, but it's not a steroid or cortisone. And what it does is it blocks one particular pathway of inflammation called the leukotriene pathway. So it's not an antihistamine in the sense that usually those antihistamines are histamine blockers, so where you have Claritin, Zyrtec, Allegra, over-the-counter, Benadryl, whatever, are histamine blockers. This medication in particular just blocks an inflammation receptor so that, again, back to the idea, then those inflammatory cells don't cause release of the histamine. So it kind of goes a step backwards. And but like with the nasal cortisone sprays, Singulair is something that should be used on a fairly routine basis to get its most benefit.
Mm-hmm. And we're out of time at this point. So thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
A lot
you.
Of interest in the topic. A lot of people who need some help. Our guest, Dr. Asriani Chu, assistant professor of medicine and pediatrics at the Medical College of Wisconsin, where she deals with allergic diseases and asthma and immunology. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program, to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I hope everybody feels better. It's a tricky area to maneuver sometimes, isn't it? Yeah. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll continue our Wednesday conversation with a very interesting look at several presidents and how they did courageous acts. First, and that's coming up in a few moments.